Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 872, interview with Paul Fitzgerald and Elizabeth Gould about Ukraine and the Earth Island. This is being recorded on November 1st of the year 2015. It is my privilege and pleasure to bring back to our airwaves Elizabeth Gould and Paul Fitzgerald, the authors of Invisible History, Afghanistan's Untold Story, that was the focal point of four previous interviews, and a follow-up book, I believe called The AFPAC War. Am I correct about the title?
Crossing Zero.
Crossing Zero.
The AFPAC War at the Turning Point of American Empire.
Okay. Both deal with events involving Afghanistan, both involving what I have termed the Earth Island, and some of these same unsavory dynamics have now manifested themselves vis-a-vis Ukraine and other things. And I think by way of refreshing the memories of listeners who have heard our first interviews and informing younger listeners who may not be aware of some of these dynamics, if you would recount for us how Zbigniew Brzezinski actually authored in many ways the Soviet involvement in Afghanistan and actually precipitated what became the first Afghan war, and then after that we will pivot to what is going on today with Ukraine.
Zbigniew Brzezinski is a very interesting character when it comes to American foreign policy. If you notice, it was parodied in Dr. Strangelove, the movie, the Stanley Kubrick movie back in the early 1960s, where you have this national security advisor played by Peter Sellers, who has this German accent, and he's planning this global attack on the Soviet Union. The crazy colonel, the crazy general, goes off and attacks the Soviet Union, and as a result of that, what we have is the Third World War, a nuclear war begins. And so, you know, at the time, everyone thought that it was a parody of the way things really work. But the fact is that, you know, someone later on, a British filmmaker, came in and just for the heck of it decided to figure out whether Dr. Strangelove was a, what the reality behind Dr. Strangelove really was. And he discovered that Dr. Strangelove is really much more of a documentary than it was a feature film or fantasy. That's what Zbigniew Brzezinski and his ilk represent. They are the cream of the crop. Zbigniew Brzezinski, Henry Kissinger, those people came into the United States in the 1950s in terms of their foreign policy influence. They went through the system, they got into the American system, and began to take what was let's put it this way, the majority of it was a moderate, kind of middle-of-the-road, Rooseveltian kind of thing, structure, and began to direct it towards their own personal approaches. And Zbigniew Brzezinski's approach to this was this idea of Halford Mackinder, which was the turn of the 20th century, the idea of this world island, that the Eurasia, the central part of the European continent with Russia, basically, which Russia occupied, was really the most important thing in the world. The whole concept of geopolitics came out of this idea during that time period, where the basic idea of geopolitics is that if you've got the piece of land with the oil on it, then and you need oil to run your civilization, your society, then you're going to devise a foreign policy that's going to say, well, let's get the oil, or let's get those resources, let's get the tin, the uranium, the whatever it is. And Eurasia is just rich in all of these things. It's rich in oil. It's rich in routes for oil from one place, from the Middle East to Europe. And so as a result of that, it has an enormous amount of importance. And so as a result of that, the students, like Brzezinski, became almost obsessed with it. So the ultimate goal is, so step number one is controlling Eurasia. That's what the Western powers wanted to do. That's what Britain, as an example, with its East India Company, has been doing since the 17th century, since 1600. It was incorporated by Queen Elizabeth I, the objective of which was to was to basically compete with other trading organizations, but to monopolize it, essentially, to get into India and work its way up into South Central Asia, which is what they did, which is how they wound, the British wound up in Afghanistan. In the meantime, the Russians were working their way down from the north, and they came to a confrontation. Towards the end of the 19th century, they came to an agreement over Afghanistan. The two forces, the Russian Empire and the British Empire, met during that in that area. But that still, and Afghanistan became at that time a neutral buffer state between the two empires. That was broken in the 1970s by the likes of Zbigniew Brzezinski and his fellow co-conspirators, if you want to call them that. What they did was they came up with a way in which they would bring the along with the Saudis and along with the some other Middle Eastern potentates, put together a covert army of radical Islamic insurgents, the object of which was to destabilize Afghanistan and Central Asia. And in the process of doing that, they used Pakistan as a base in order to do that, but they also involved China as well. So there was a lot of the geopolitics involved Sino-Soviet issues that went back to the Sino-Soviet War. They played the China card. Brzezinski played the China card against Russia. Yes, Liz.
I just wanted to add one thing about Brzezinski that also, I think, sets up the power he came with when he really was given the job of National Security Advisor by President Carter. You have to realize that the fact is it was actually Brzezinski who actually effectively chose Governor Carter effectively for the next president. After David Rockefeller had started the Trilateral Commission and made Brzezinski the head of it, basically he invited Carter to join it, and that was the beginning of the relationship, and that became the foundation. So when Carter was elected, basically on a peace platform and on détente and all these other things, I think it should have been noted by the mainstream media that the big sign that couldn't possibly be true was the Zbigniew Brzezinski being signed on as National Security Advisor. And from the day one, literally, of his being set up as National Security Advisor, he began the agenda that Paul was just describing. He came into the president's office that
the catalyst, I think we have to conclude this as well, that the catalyst for this was the U.S. loss in Vietnam. In 1975, the United States officially withdrew from Vietnam, even though the war was clearly lost years before, after the Tet Offensive in 1968. But it took years for the political machinery of Washington to get around to figuring out a way that it could leave gracefully, and that's when Henry Kissinger became involved. So Zbigniew Brzezinski picked up. Carter gets elected in 1976, and in the beginning of 1977, immediately begins to agitate against the Soviet Union. They had said, well, we can't sit around any longer with this thing called détente. We really have to go in and start undermining the Soviet Union on a realistic basis. We're getting defeated by the Russians and by the communists all over the world. In South America, there were leftist movements. In Africa, there were leftist movements. There was a whole issue about the Soviet fleet in the Indian Ocean. So there were all kinds of things that were occurring during that time period. And there was a lot of, needless to say, America's military-industrial complex, which Eisenhower had warned about, was more than happy to get the engine up and running and started again. There was a lot of support at the highest levels of American government and American business to get this thing up and running again. And so what they did was they started agitating around the Soviet borders. They agitated in Eastern Europe, they were agitating in Poland, and they were agitating in Afghanistan. And that was with the help of the Saudis. The Saudis became involved. And so by 1978, 1979, they had been doing this actually since 1973. The beginnings of it were there in 1973 through Pakistan, but the U.S. wasn't involved directly. But when the Marxists took over in 1978, they went full speed. Brzezinski went to China, made a deal with the Chinese to get involved in training some of the rebels. The Pakistanis were involved in training some of the rebels. And bit by bit, in July, I believe it was, of 1979, Brzezinski got President Carter to sign a finding a memorandum that basically suggested that in support of this insurgency in Afghanistan, knowing full well and telling the president this will probably draw the Russians into Afghanistan, which is what we want, so we can give them their Vietnam. And so that was the whole purpose of this covert operation, and it was intentionally done to lure the Soviets into their own Vietnam, and it worked like a charm.
It did, and of course, our history has recorded in such a way as that it was the Russian bear trying to advance across the Earth Island so that they could get control of Middle Eastern oil, which they did not need. And we have been subjected to what amounts to a big lie. By the way, a quick background note. You were talking about Dr. Strangelove. And both Henry Kissinger, as as we have examined in, for the record, 731, and Zbigniew Brzezinski, as we have spoken about in AFA number 3, worked inextricably with the Third Reich espionage establishment that we incorporated at the end of World War II. So the Dr. Strangelove analogy is brutally relevant in this context. Now, in a recent piece that both of you co-authored, and by the way, good, excellent, I would say, background information on the Afghan war and the dynamics that Paul and Elizabeth have been talking about here are available in their first book, Invisible History, Afghanistan's Untold Story, that was the focal point of four different interviews that we have done. Now, recently, earlier this year, you co-authored a piece in Op-Ed News about the further adventures of Zbigniew Brzezinski, if we were going to be using this as an old-time radio serial. And now Citizen Brzezinski is holding forth about Ukraine and what we need to do or what we should have done or perhaps what we are doing vis-a-vis Ukraine. I wonder if you would reflect not only on what Brzezinski has had to say or what his delightful son Ian has had to say, but about how the dynamic of Ukraine fits into the dynamic of the Earth Island, the World Island, and some of the things that you have chronicled in your book.
Well, one of the things that Mackinder established was that that Eastern Central Europe would be the so-called pivot area for attaining control over Eurasia. Now, Brzezinski elaborated on that in his book, The Grand Chessboard, in which he stated that it was very important for the West, after the Cold War ended, to draw Ukraine into the Western orbit for the simple reason that without Ukraine, Russia could no longer be an empire. Russia would lose an enormous aspect of itself. Now, the Ukraine, of course, were the origin. The Kievan Rus were the original Russians before they went off to the north and east and settled into those areas that we now think of as Russia. So the origin of the Russian people themselves and the Russian soul is in Kiev. Was in the Ukraine. So it's very close to what we think of today as Russian ideology or Russian nationalism, as Ukraine is almost central to it. So, but the Western part of it was very much more influenced by Western ideals than the Russian ideals of the East. And so as a result of that, you've got these Eastern part. In fact, I believe until right up until World War II, I think that the western part of Ukraine was under the auspices of Poland. So Brzezinski, being a xenophobic Polish patriot, certainly had a great deal of interest in reeling in at least the part of Ukraine, western Ukraine, where Kiev exists, in terms of it being a pivot area. And actually, he actually points out the fact that if the West can't draw... this is in his book. He points out the fact that if the West can't draw Ukraine into its orbit, then Poland would become the pivot of Eurasia.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
Which is very interesting because that, of course... That may be the fallback position all along. If Kiev is a basket case, as we know. As anybody who reads the Financial Times or the New York Times or any other periodical realizes, especially if you realize, if you read the European magazines, if you go online and read Der Spiegel, I mean, they're basically, you know, pretty flat out in terms of Ukraine is bankrupt, it's corrupted. The people that the United States has put in power there are basically not capable of running anything. And so if you look at also, too, if you look at the American-Ukrainian Chamber of Commerce, it's online, the number of companies that are involved in doing that. There's so many big issues there. The Russians don't want, the Russians and a lot of the Europeans don't want GMO foods, as an example. Well, you know, needless to say, the companies that are benefiting from GMO foods are all American, and they want to get into the Ukraine and start planting the Ukrainian breadbasket with all this Ukrainian genetically modified organisms. And so you've got these fundamental core issues that are going on between East and West, and Russia is standing on the other side of this and saying, absolutely not, we're not going to let you do this.
But in 1997, when Brzezinski wrote his book, you know, this was at a time when Russia clearly was, you know, reeling from the financial shenanigans that basically had been put on them once the demise of the Soviet Union occurred. And Boris Yeltsin obviously really let them go pretty wild until he left in 1999 and Putin came in.
In a drunken stupor.
Right. But so, you know, so the attitude really towards the Soviet Union, and we all know now that there were a lot of supposed promises made to Gorbachev that there would be no movement of NATO to the border once they agreed to allow the reunification of Germany. So you had a lot of issues in that time period which clearly were just taking advantage of the weakness of Russia, because part of the weakness of Russia wasn't just so much the end of the Soviet Union, but it was the complete decimation of their entire national economy. Apparently something like 100 million people were made destitute by the complete rape of the national economy and the oligarchs effectively being empowered at that point. So at that moment in 1997, you know, Russia was probably not in much of a position to really focus on what was being said. But as things began to change in 2000, the beginning of Putin starts affecting things, you begin to notice over time comments being made. Historically, if you look back at Putin's speeches, you can see that there's a lot of hinting going on, that they're aware of the fact that there is a movement towards Russia, that there is a movement of the NATO countries, and these are not the kinds of things that show goodwill and all of that. But it clearly wasn't until the Georgia invasion when there was a realization that something had shifted. So we think that probably at this point, you know, we're looking at the actions of the United States finally coming up against the actual resistance of Russia that they really never have encountered before. And that is part of what Brzezinski seems to be trying to influence now, you know, in the way that he always approaches things. Clearly, you know, is the fact that the United States clearly is supposed to be in charge of the world. That is the attitude, that's the position. But the predictions that he has made that the United States had to control the Ukraine in order to really in order to stop Russia now has actually come to an end, effectively. There really is nothing more that they can do at this point. There's a lot of chatter about it, but there really isn't very much being done. Poroshenko has been told a number of times by the Germans and the French that they really have to accept the Minsk Agreement. There's still, we know, a lot of reporting by the New York Times and the various mainstream media here that constantly refer to the fact that, you know, Russia is not holding up the agreement. But when you listen to the Europeans direct their attention to what's going on in Ukraine, it's pretty obvious that that's not really what's going on. So at this point in the world where we now have a new focus, we have the focus in Syria. Now that has completely shifted a lot of the attention that the Ukraine was getting and the geopolitical implications of controlling Ukraine. Now that really has come down to the point where Brzezinski is now far more focused on Syria at this point, and far more focused on trying to influence American policy in Syria. So in terms of the speed at which things are happening and the challenges that these are to the American position of power, but what we've also got to go back, and this is where going back into history is so important. When you do look at the attitudes that Brzezinski really inaugurated in 1977, when he got in there as National Security Advisor, he inaugurated a very active policy of stimulating Islamic fundamentalism. And Graham Fuller, by the way, played a big role back in, you know, he was actually the station chief in Kabul from 1973 to 78. And that was the time when Brzezinski really, you know, as Brzezinski came in 77, he really activated these policies, and Graham Fuller was right there. And a lot of what is not fully appreciated by the attitudes that a man like Graham Fuller has is the attitudes towards Islamic fundamentalism and the use of Islam, okay, itself. I mean, this is a quote from Fuller. I think this was in 1999. In the West, the words Islamic fundamentalism conjures up images of bearded men with turbans and women covered in black shrouds. And some Islamist movements may indeed contain reactionary and violent elements, but we should not let stereotypes blind us in the fact that there are also powerful modernizing forces at work within these movements. Political Islam is about change. In this sense, modern Islamist movements may be the main vehicle for bringing about change in the Muslim world and the breakup of the old dinosaur regimes. Islam is solidly rooted in traditions of mercantilism and private enterprise. Islam does not glorify the role of the state in the economy, be it communism or socialism, or in general, Islam is quite compatible with modern ideas of a limited state role in the economy. It has regularly opposed the introduction of socialist measures in the Muslim world and expresses the preferences for market principles. The Islamist attacks on capitalism is usually a reference to consumerism or intense materialism that they see as a negative characteristic of the West. Islamists want less borders among Muslim states and see the European Union as a potential model. That, I think, gives you a very clear indication of the actual relationship that Brzezinski and that is going on with people who basically are really supporting, that this has everything to do with the pan-Islamic movement, with bringing back the caliphate, and how it is compatible with the globalists' agenda.
That is a very important point, and I want to revisit that at some length. So let's hold that for a second. Talking about your op-ed piece, and I guess you could say that Daddy Brzezinski has spawned or divided like an amoeba, and now we are treated to some of his delightful little children. And in your op-ed news piece, you relate, it is at one level terrifying and at another level infuriating and perhaps to some perhaps almost unbelievable. Ian Brzezinski, his son, has been weighing in on the Ukrainian crisis and had a stunning recommendation about our military chain of command and how it should be altered. I wonder if you would detail that for us.
Well, one of the things that he suggested a few months ago was that that the chain of command in terms of the use of nuclear weapons, which has always been kind of an issue. We go back to Dr. Strangelove. You know, who actually has the ability when you have all these nuclear weapons floating around? How do you get the chain of command to react correctly when it comes to actually using them? That Ian Brzezinski suggested openly in congressional testimony that there would be too much of a time lag between needing to use the nuclear weapons if the Russians advanced on NATO forces, and that the use of those nuclear weapons should be put into the hands of the NATO commander in charge of these forces that were facing the Russians, instead of waiting for it to go through the chain of command in Washington, you know, as if it would really make a difference. The fact is that once it's over, it's over. I mean, the whole idea about mutual assured destruction, which was developed in the 1950s and 1960s, was that, you know, the whole objective was to decapitate the enemy,
Well, you know, and it have a limited response. You know, use a nuclear weapon here, use a nuclear weapon there as a demonstration of force. But the fact is that once you start decapitating the enemy and destroying their command communications and computers, which is what the whole objective, they call it C4. It used to be C3, command, control, and communications. Now it's there's a fourth C. It's computers as well. Once you've destroyed that, the enemy has no way of saying to itself, to telling its commanders, okay, the war's over, stop, don't fire those extra nuclear weapons. You've got those 5,000 more nuclear weapons. The fact is that it's a free-for-all. It's a cafeteria food fight with nuclear weapons. I mean, this is a wonderful way to conduct world policy. I mean, the childish nature of this whole thing is absolutely absurd. It's so absurd that it's beyond belief, and I think that that's where the people think to themselves. I remember having conversations with people back in the 1980s, and you know, you'd go to these events where the nuclear freeze movement or something like that, and you'd be talking with someone, and they'd say, "Why, they can't, you know, we can't be protected. They can't have a nuclear war because we'll all get killed." I said, "Yeah, I mean, that is kind of, you know, have you heard about some of these things that where they basically project that only 5% of the population is necessary to survive in the United States, and if that 5% actually has the capability of surviving and would be to their benefit to sit down in a bunker for 5 or 10 years and wait it out until the radiation cooled down enough for them to come back up again, why wouldn't they want to do that? Well, they can't live without me." Oh, really? Is that that's a conceit that most people have. And when you actually get into these things and you actually start talking to some of these nuclear thinkers and you start reading about some of the things that they put out, you really begin to realize that there is a level of insanity, and I mean that with a capital I, insanity involved in some of these think tanks and their projections in terms of what they can do with their technology. You know, the technology itself is very seductive. The United States foreign policy apparatus and military apparatus at the end of World War II, they said, well, now we have this atomic bomb, so we control everything. So because they have this technological superweapon, they really don't have to deal with the nitty-gritty of actually planning the nip and tuck of actually fighting real land wars and ground wars, and they've lost their sense of reality that goes along with doing these things. And I think when you look at what they did in Vietnam as an example, what they did in Iraq, what they did in Afghanistan, the American military, the Western military, NATO was there. It wasn't just the Americans. Germany was there. France was there. We met some of these guys when we went there, the International Security and Assistance Force. They don't have the background and the experience, let's say, that the German army and the Russian army had in World War II, the Italian army had in World War II. They're holding ground, holding territory, taking towns and cities and that sort of thing. The United States goes in there, into Iraq. Even the British complained in Iraq about the way in which the United States was just basically bombing and trashing everything that it could find in Iraq. There was no subtlety to the American approach. It was total power projection, get out of our way, we're driving over it. And now we're left with a situation in the world where the United States is now seen as this kind of blundering giant that comes in and destroys anything and whatever it touches. Afghanistan is a disaster. Iraq is a disaster. All they have is the ability to fly F-16s over these places and knock out desert warehouses that have been knocked out 5 times already.
Unfortunately, though, when it came to Afghanistan, part of the agenda may very well have been to destroy the nation of Afghanistan, that ending its sovereignty, in fact, was the British agenda going back to the 19th century.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
There are many Afghans today who will tell you that they believe that Britain is running American foreign policy and the goal was to destroy Afghanistan's sovereignty. So, you know, in terms of the deep roots and the deep implications of what's going on today, it does make it difficult sometimes when the stated goal seems to be to bring democracy and freedom, and, you know, instead of we end up with countries that are completely destroyed. And it really doesn't add up because so much of the underlying motivations are really not reported and really not part of the narrative that most people understand.
Elizabeth and Paul, I would like to come back to the issue of Islamism, corporatism, transnational, quote, free enterprise, unquote, and perhaps even Graham Fuller and some of his more recent activities. But before we leave, at least for the time being, the Brzezinski family, I was unaware, I don't watch television as a rule, but in addition to his charming son, Ian, who has been, in effect, banging the drum has become a male cheerleader for what could be nuclear war. His charming daughter, Mika, is a co-host on CNBC and is therefore sort of dishing up, you know, Brzezinski fare to the national TV audience.
No question about it. And she was in there with Dan Rather. I couldn't believe when the World Trade Towers were attacked on September 11, 2001, that Dan Rather basically called on Mika Brzezinski live to give her analysis of what was going on in Lower Manhattan. And so here you have the daughter of the guy reporting from the site on the ultimate consequences of her father's foreign policy manipulations from the 1970s. In fact, his lifelong manipulations. He'd proposed this whole ethnic nationalities uprising inside the Soviet Union from the early on in the 1950s and then into the 1960s, and had to revise it a few times by the time he got to be national security head in the Carter administration. But you know, here are the two of them. It was a surreal moment. Let's put it that way.
Well, part of the surreal moment for us was also the fact that when we dealt with CBS News originally about the first trip, you know, we encountered the origins of a narrative that was being created for the American public. That's what we really came up against. And of course, Dan Rather had just become the managing editor of CBS News when we did our trip. And we really didn't bring back the story that they really wanted to show. So that was our initiation. So seeing Dan Rather, who eventually, during the 1980s, Dan Rather was actually charged by a number of mainstream journalists covering Afghanistan, including Mary Williams Walsh, who was the Wall Street Journal reporter in Afghanistan at the time, would have been, you know, during the Soviet occupation, that Dan Rather was airing on CBS News Mike Hoover's work, which was basically phony footage. And there was a huge controversy that went on for quite a few years trying to publicize by a number of journalists like Mary Williams Walsh the fact that at CBS News and Dan Rather were putting on false stories. I think they said Mike Hoover had used at one point the Pakistani Air Force and claimed it was the Soviet Air Force, things like that, pretty blatant. So here's Dan Rather with Mika Brzezinski. You know, the irony of that for us was overwhelming.
Well, you know, they refer to TSA and all of these things as the Homeland Security as National Security Theater. And the truth is, Dave, is it really is theater. This is a show. It's a dog and pony show that they put on for the American public, and they get people thinking that they're actually doing something, that they're defending our freedoms, and that we're going to send our brave boys off to wherever. And our boys are brave. Let you know. The problem is that they put the weight of this nonsense that they've been putting out, this propaganda campaign, to justify their interventions and their imperialism, essentially, which is looking more and more like 19th century imperialism. They put the weight of that on our soldiers and our men and women who are in our armed forces, who are doing the best they can possibly can to defend the real. We have real enemies. We have created real enemies in the world. We need people to believe in the idea of defending our country. But these false images of what has been put out, the narrative has been so doctored and is so confused at this point in the 21st century that it's almost impossible to know at this point what is really going on in the world, because you have, as an American, you have no frame of reference, unless you listen to a show like yours, have an idea
of the kind of complexities that are involved. As you mentioned earlier, the United States basically hired the Galen operation, Reinhard Galen's operation, as you know, at the end of World War II, which was the stay-behind operation that he had developed for the Gestapo, for German intelligence. He had worked on developing all his agents in Eastern Europe and in Russia, who were basically going to go in, when the Soviets came into Europe, these guys were going to be there as the stay-behind people who were going to be doing the destabilization process and whatnot from that time period on. And so as a result of that, this is what we have. We have, you know, this is what the American government has been doing since then, and with a propaganda campaign that has been initiated, a cultural campaign that was initiated in Europe by the Cultural Congress, Creative Cultural Congress, back in the early 1950s, the object of which was to basically get into all the media, get into journalism, get it into the literary world, impact the agents that buy the material. But the CIA, I believe, even purchased Orwell's Animal Farm, I believe. Yeah, they purchased it themselves. I mean, here's one of the greatest critics of what he saw as the potential for a police state, George Orwell, and the CIA goes and buys his work. I mean, you know, and they talked about the fact that people who were basically being employed were people who were, you know, they didn't ask who was paying their salaries because they didn't want to know, because these were people who weren't getting paid before, and all of a sudden in the 1930s and the 1940s and suddenly in the 1950s, the CIA comes along with all this money and says, you can work for us, you can write for us, you can write in these very prestigious magazines and put your ideas out there. And so, you know, this is all how it got controlled. And so, and here we are way downstream, and the narrative has been so entirely corrupted, and people's thinking has been so entirely indoctrinated that they don't know left from right, up from down, who our allies really are. And I think the Ukrainian situation is what's revealing that. It was what was revealing that, and as it became unraveled, the whole issue of the Nazis, you could see that Christina Manapour, as an example, on CNN, went ballistic one night on Wolf Blitzer when he mentioned the fact that Nazis were actually parading in the streets of Kiev and parading against Russia, and she went ballistic on him. And he said, please, Christine, I'm just trying to illustrate the fact. I didn't say it. They're saying it. The Russians are saying that these are Nazis. And she's saying, oh, you have to be very careful about doing this sort of thing. So about saying the word Nazi, because they're not Nazis. They're freedom-loving patriots for the Ukraine, blah, 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 blah. But this is the narrative. They're crossing themselves up in this process. You know, the devil is getting his tail caught in the door at this point, because it's so complicated, and they've been doing it for so long, and unfortunately, they're still in a position, as you mentioned, what's going on in Syria right now. They're in a position where Russia and China are both challenging the United States authority, the Wolfowitz Doctrine, the 1992 Wolfowitz Doctrine, where he said that the United States had to act as if, you know, an unchallenged superiority. We have to project force all over the world. And the fact is that anybody who studied the use of force knows that it's just the threat of the use of force that functions. Once you use the force, there's a limit to how much you can do, how much you can sustain it, and the benefit from which you're going to get it.
Well, there was a paper actually written called
The
Known Unknowns.
By Nathan Freer.
Yeah, and...
excuse me one second. Could you spell that gentleman's last name for us, for people that would maybe like to do an internet
you can
search?
Get it. You can get it online. It's a U.S. military, U.S. Army document. It's a PDF file. It's called Known Unknowns. And the author's name is Nathan, N-A-T-H-A-N, Freer. F-R-I-E-R.
Okay.
I believe it's free. That's the spelling of Freer. And he basically, he laid it out.
This would have been, 10 years ago, maybe?
2006, something like that.
Yeah,
think
10 years ago, right.
Yeah. And he laid it out, and he said, you know, he said that 9/11 was a strategic shock to the United States. They did not, the military establishment, the intelligence establishment did not anticipate that something like that could or would happen. So that was a strategic shock. And then the Iraq War, 2003, that was another strategic shock. They did not expect that they would get the kind of resistance that they got. They're living in a kind of delusional fantasy land, okay, with this imperial power that they have. They think they can project power, so... And Madeleine Albright allegedly said at one point, she said, if we have this great army, why can't we use it? We have this great military power that's our ace in the hole. Why aren't we using it? So the neoconservatives got into power and they started using it. The problem is that when you use it, there are limits on it. And this is what Nathan Freer points out in this very, very illuminating document. And he states the fact that we're going to get to the point where the United States was going to be the one that was going to be contained. The United States was not going to be containing Russia or China. It was Russia, China, and Eastern and Europe, and South America, the BRIC nations, the SCO, South China Cooperation Organization, that was going to be containing the United States. And we're kind of at the cusp of that right now. The United States is really, you probably remember General William Odom. He was a, he's deceased now, but he was Zbigniew Brzezinski's military assistant when he was at the National Security Council. And he was a very conservative, he was a general, he was very conservative, very pro-American. And he commented, he was already retired in 2004, 2005, and he commented on what was going on with the United States in the Iraq War. And he said, it is America's Stalingrad. That is what the Iraq War was. Well, that was over a decade ago that he stated that. And the impact of that on the American military in terms of its being a strategic shock, it was more than a strategic shock. In Odom's opinion, it was Stalingrad. The United States poured its resources, it poured its financial treasure, it poured its best military equipment, it showed what it had and how it did everything, its operations, and it didn't succeed. So if the United States can do that with a country like Iraq, which had been under embargo for at least a decade, did not have anywhere near the military capability that the United States and the Western nations had, If a country like Iraq could do that to the world's most impressive military institution, then how does Washington think it's going to deal with the Russian army, the Russian Air Force, the Russian high-tech country, the Chinese? American military experts have warned for years, the one thing you don't do is get involved in a war in Asia, period. Simple. You don't do it, okay? It was a big issue back in the 1950s about the nightmare of that Korea became. So here we are again with our military in Washington, not just our military, but our political infrastructure, acting as if they're going to take control and push Russia out of Syria, push Russia out of Ukraine, and start telling them what to do all over again. I'm afraid the horse is out of the barn, as they say, and as William Odom said, you know, we already experienced, the United States already experienced its Waterloo, its Stalingrad. We know what happened to
we know what happened to
Germany after
right.
Stalingrad.
We know what happened to Napoleon too.
After Waterloo, exactly.
Right.
So
right.
You know, we're coming quickly to a showdown here. Yeah. The question I think really at this time is that whether that showdown is going to actually be and the United States backs off in terms of its posture, which is possible, or whether there will actually be a confrontation between the United States and Russia. And if it does, then, you know, it's all bets are off in terms of, you know, how that's going to play out.
It will probably be the end of all of us. Here on November 1st, this is All Souls Day, and we may be in for a real All Souls Day at some point in the future if this, at one level, grotesque theater, and at another level, apocalyptic strategic maneuvering is allowed to continue and get out of hand.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
Well, if it get, you know, you have a situation where it's clearly a very, very dangerous situation. The fact is that in terms of international law, the Assad government is the elected government of Syria, and they invited the Russians to come in there and help defend their government. So in terms of international law and precedent, international precedent, then the Russians are there lawfully defending that government. If the United States puts boots on the ground, which they are now going to do, and they come head-to-head against Russians defending the Syrian government, then the United States is the aggressor in that situation.
Right. Well, actually, there was a representative from Hawaii who was on CNN this week who stated very articulately the fact that the United States cannot actually get on the ground in Syria. These are things. There's no legal way that the United States can actually engage in any kind of war.
It's illegal for the United
There's
States.
There's no, yeah.
One of the interesting things to look at, hello?
Yes.
Okay. One of the things to look at very quickly, I'm encouraging listeners to look at a globe or a map, see where Syria and Ukraine are in relation to Russia, and see where they are in relation to the U.S. We have a little over 10 minutes left in this interview, and I can see that at least one, if not two or three more interviews would be in order. I'd like to, although we can't even begin to do justice to this, but earlier, Elizabeth, you were talking about the corporatist / Islamist ideology, and Graham Fuller, you also made a reference to Georgia. I would note that Mikhail Saakashvili, who was the president of Georgia when it had that war with Russia, is now the governor of the Ukrainian province of Odessa, and yet he is facing criminal charges in his own country and cannot go back. The rationale for that was that an oligarch in Odessa named Kolomoyskoy, and I may be mispronouncing that, had too much influence and that this would moderate his influence. Yet Kolomoyskoy's companies, his conglomerate Privat, Privat, was known to have done land office business, so to speak, in Georgia, which adds an interesting perspective on that. But as we contemplate Islamists and Syria and what we think of as the Middle East, we should note that among the combatant elements in Ukraine now are some Chechen Islamist fighters who were not only associated with the Islamic State or ISIS, but are now fighting in Ukraine under the administrative command of Pravi Sektor, one of the overt Nazi elements in the Ukrainian political and national security establishment. I wonder, in the few minutes we have left, and we will have to continue this, do you see, what are your thoughts, I should say, with regard to now having ISIS-linked Chechen Islamists fighting in Ukraine at the same time as Russia has now moved into Syria in a formal military standpoint? Do you see those things as connected, or what are your thoughts on those relationships and juxtapositions?
Well, there's no question that Russia has been talking about the issue of terrorism for a long time, and they've had an issue obviously with the Chechen situation that's been, rather well known. There is a lot of, at this point, I think there's a lot of evidence to suggest that Russia actually tried to warn the United States about the individuals, the Chechens, that were supposedly responsible for the Boston Marathon bombing, that these individuals were well known and that they were warning the United States about them. So there's no question that the implication is that, Russia is looking at the terrorist situation in terms of its effect on Russia. What we've just given you is the history that Brzezinski inaugurated to actually use terrorists to destabilize the first the Soviet Union, but then, and here is another quote that we have on the attitude that these kinds of individuals have, the policy of guiding the evolution of Islam of helping them against our adversaries worked marvelously well in Afghanistan against the Russians. The same doctrines can still be used to destabilize what remains of Russian power and especially to counter the Chinese influence in Central Asia. Now, this is one of the people that, along with Graham Fuller, this is the attitude that these individuals, this clique has towards the use of this, of terrorists against Russia or against China. So I think what we're seeing is that they are now taking action about that. It isn't, I don't think, that they were unaware that it was happening. I don't think that they necessarily either it was the right time or other issues were more important at the time. But there's no question that action now is being taken, and that's what's clearly going on in Syria, that the fear that between the refugee situation and the terrorist situation, this obviously was the reason why Russia decided that it had to take action at this point.
You mentioned that Dan Rather had Mika Brzezinski on after the 9/11 attacks. It is interesting because that obviously was blowback from our support for the Afghan Mujahideen in Brzezinski's first Islamist-led foray into the Earth Island. And you mentioned Graham Fuller. His former son-in-law was Uncle Ruslan. He was the uncle for the Tsarnaev brothers and basically the media spokesperson after the Boston Marathon bombing. And Uncle Ruslan had formed a political front with Graham Fuller, which was called Chechen International. And I would also note that the, quote, tutor, unquote, of Sokar Tsarnaev was a, quote, ex-unquote CIA officer named Brian Glynn Williams. And I think one of the really disturbing things to me is that when people begin to actually examine some of the topography of covert operations or some of the structural architecture, immediately our media, and even, sadly, I think so much of the so-called progressive political sector say, oh, my, that's conspiracy theory. I don't like that. Well, you know, how did people like the Boston Marathon bombing? I'm not implying that I think Graham Fuller was responsible for that, but rather I think that was blowback from what appears to be another covert operation using Islamists against Russia, this one in the Caucasus.
Well, yes. I mean, that was no question about it. And the Russian Federal Security Bureau warned on at least two occasions that the FBI, that they were that they should be watched, that they were dangerous, the Tsarnaev brothers. And, you know, they passed muster with the American authorities. So, you know, I think you've really got you have an issue where we, as I mentioned to you before, we have a national security theater here, and the screen is ripped and the curtain is partially open, and you can see the manipulations going on behind the scenes. If you actually compare the narratives and you actually lay it out and you ask for the evidence of these things, you don't get it. You don't get it, okay? There was a lot of hope that the trial of the Tsarnaevs would bring out some of these connections and Brzezinski's nationalities working group that he started in 1977, and with some people. It was a rump organization. He had people from the State Department in it. He had National Security Council from the CIA and a bunch of different people trying to find all of these people that they could recruit in Dagestan and Chechnya and Azerbaijan and Kazakhstan and these various other places that they could get to incite against communism. And so that was the whole objective of this. And William Casey, the CIA director during the Reagan administration, was more than happy to continue this and get this thing going. And the problem with the Afghan war was that ultimately all of this stuff became privatized. It got outside the avenues of restraint and control and oversight, as bad as they were to begin with, on these kinds of programs that the CIA was running.
They got outside that and they became self-fulfilling prophecies. They became self-licking ice cream cones. They were funded by drugs and the arms supplies. And coming out of Afghanistan, Afghanistan is the largest, I mean, the amounts of heroin that are being produced in that area, it's just, it's unfathomable, and it just doesn't get talked about anymore. There's a heroin outbreak in the United States right now. The addiction rates are going crazy. We've got stories every day in the Boston Globe about all of these small towns in New England that are suffering. Mount Washington Valley, this beautiful place up there, very simple, straightforward, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, Vermont, Maine, all these little towns, they're being preyed upon by heroin dealers. I mean, it's unbelievable, and nobody's connecting the dots. Our major media is just sitting back and acting as if it's 1947 and then the Cold War is back in vogue and you know, everyone's going to be happy again working at that arms plant or that B-25 factory. You know, it isn't going to be like that. It isn't going to be like that at all. Then World War III is going to be a cyber war. It's going to be biological. It's going to be all kinds of terror that nobody's ever experienced before. So, I mean, we got to wake up. If we're going to wake up at all, now's the time to wake up. It's time to tell your audience. Time to snap your fingers and think about, start thinking, listen to all your programs, Dave. You've been there all along. You've been doing this stuff diligently and doing such a wonderful job. People have got to start realizing that there is a malignant force at work in the world.
I would note that with the epidemic of heroin addiction in New England and other small towns in the U.S., the opium poppy is not native to the U.S. It doesn't grow here. So that is coming in from someplace else.
Right. I mean, and it doesn't dawn on people that Afghanistan, after 14 years of U.S. occupation, military occupation, happens to have that at historic levels of opium production and heroin export?
Well, as I said before, the agenda, deep agenda, appears to have been to destroy Afghan sovereignty. And that is the global agenda, basically, to destroy national sovereignty. I mean, the PTT agreement that's being pushed now, the trade agreement, is clearly challenging the very idea of national sovereignty having any power against corporate interests, period. Where we are.
Yep, Paul and Elizabeth, we have got to carry this on in at least one more interview, if not more. However, we are all out of time. I'd like to, first of all, solicit where people can get your books. I'd also like to close the program with a couple of quotes immediately apposite to what Elizabeth said. Mussolini defined fascism. He said, "Il fascismo e il corporatismo." Fascism is corporatism. And as we watch, on the one hand, this just almost adolescent humor that has been disseminated about President Putin and all this stuff, it reminds me of Edith Wharton, who observed the quote, "A frivolous society can only achieve dramatic significance through what its frivolity destroys." And I'm afraid we are approaching that. Where can people get your books?
Well, we have a website, invisiblehistory.com, where both our books are right there on the front cover. You certainly can go to the website, because that way you'll be sure of getting the correct title, Invisible History, Afghanistan's Untold Story, and Crossing Zero, the AFPAC War, the Turning Point of American Empire.
All righty, and there are four previous interviews with Elizabeth and Paul about Invisible History, the first of their two books, which will provide invaluable background on what we are seeing today. This concludes For the Record Program 872, interview with Elizabeth Gould and Paul Fitzgerald about Ukraine and Invisible History. This is Dave Emery saying, for Elizabeth and Paul, saying thanks for listening. We are recording this on November 1st of the year 2015.